Hi, and welcome to this week's episode of The Wagon, with me, Finty Williams, and my colleague and friend, John McEwen. As always, this is only possible with the help of Abitha Calm, a residential clinic specialising in addictions and mental health. Without their support, this podcast would definitely not have been possible.
And this week we have an amazing guest. I think he's a legend. I've been privileged to know him for a very long time. And just aside from what we're going to talk about today, he's always been willing to help me in the past with fundraising events when we've been trying to get some money together to help people go through addiction treatments and other things. And even took up time to come up to Liverpool that one mad night we had pre-Christmas. His name is Chris Difford, founder of Squeeze. He's a musician, songwriter, producer, manager, has two Novello Awards to his name, and has written and produced, played many, many hits, including Cool for Cats,
my favourite,
Up to Junction, and many, many more. Chris, you were also compared, you and Glenn, to Lennon and McCartney in your day.
We were.
And I can't really think of a higher compliment. It was obviously meant at the time. And
yeah. Well, it was meant. The difference was they were loaded and we weren't.
Okay. But look, it's a long career, a long span. Of many ups and downs, I'm sure, and I just wanted to say thank you for coming in to take the time to talk about your story, really. And I'd like to also thank you for the times that you've stepped up and helped with various charities we've helped set up, including that mad night in Liverpool a few years ago.
Yes.
When we were helping set up the Shaw Project, so thank you very much for that.
No problem.
So we're going to get into the story, if we can. And as we talked about earlier, if you could just tell us your story. We're going to focus mainly on addiction and, of course, mental health today. Hmm. When did it start for you?
What, the drinking?
The drinking, the drugging, or whatever your story is. Some people talk about gambling at a very early age. How did yours manifest?
Mine manifest because, I guess, in the early 70s... I was sort of meandering around, wondering what to do with myself. I lived on a council estate. There were a load of skinheads. I became a skinhead. And it became fashionable to drink party sevens and take take sort of Mandrax, as it were, at the time. And that was quite compelling, I suppose. But then after that all died away, all that skinhead stuff, I became a hippie. And everybody around me was smoking dope. And I just thought, well, I better do the same sort of thing. So it just became a daily ritual, really. You know, scoring, becoming, you know, stoned, and then trying to get over it the next day. And I didn't really know, really, that it was doing me any damage. I was just getting quieter and quieter. I mean, I'm a quiet person anyway, so to get quieter was a strange thing. And I became a bit of a dealer for a while, and just really enjoyed the friendship of drugs and alcohol. And then, of course, being in a band, there's that high of being on stage. And when you're young, you kind of can't quite cope with the high because you're not quite sure what that feeling is. So you end up trying to quell it with alcohol and drugs. And I did that on a daily basis from the age of about 18 to the age of 38. Wow. without a break, every day. Mm. Even when I was in hospital with illness, I would drink. So there was never a day off, which was incredible. I really enjoyed it. I have to say, it was amazing.
But it's extraordinary how you were doing it from such an early age to take yourself out of yourself, your surroundings. You were you were identifying with groups away from who you were.
Yeah, I was learning not to communicate, and that's a skill. And of course, it ended up in the 80s, when sort of cocaine was like, you know, was like the currency, if you like, when you're in a band. Mm. When I would just lock everybody out of my world, even though we were playing Madison Square Garden, you know, instead of celebrating afterwards, I'd go back to the hotel on my own with a gram of cocaine or more and just get drunk and take the drugs without anybody around. I just wanted to be on my own, which is a really strange thing, really. You're supposed to be celebrating with your mates, you know. And that just ruined all my relationships. You know, I'd been married at that point and I wasn't communicating. I wasn't enjoying having kids yet. I had them, you know, because the drugs and the alcohol came first.
Mm. And when did you think it was starting to get to that stage where it became more important than the relationships around you?
In probably 1979, 1980, around that time, I guess, was when it became really important. You know, I'd wake up in the morning with a real turkey of a hangover and I'd have to chase that all day to keep it in its pen. And then and then I'd let it out and I'd be off again.
Because also we interviewed Matt Willis, who was saying that they got to a point where he'd turn up for a photo shoot at 11 o'clock in the morning and somebody would put a beer into his hand because the two went sort of hand in hand. So it must have been really hard at that point to go, oh, hang on, there's a disconnect here, there's something not right, because it must have been so prevalent.
Well, it was, but, I wasn't alone. I mean, everybody that I knew was in the same place, but they just didn't have the addiction skills that I had. Mm. And that's kind of family-orientated disease, if you like. Mm. You know, I'd quite easily stolen that from my mum, I think. But that doesn't matter. I mean, I enjoy it. I go, you know, I'm not looking back and crying over my past. I'm saying, wow, what a fantastic journey I've had, because without that, I wouldn't be here today. Mm. And I'm so pleased that, you know, it was dark, but it was dark for a reason. I wrote some great songs being dark. There's a whole album of darkness called Play, which Squeeze recorded. There's songs on there like there's a song called Walk a Straight Line because I couldn't walk a straight line. There's a song called The Truth because I couldn't tell the truth. A song called Letting Go, which is about relationships. I mean, it was a really dark record to make. And I spent the whole time in Los Angeles behind curtains, being on my own and just being, in a wonderfully warm, addictive space.
Do you look back on that album, if you listen to it now, do you look back and almost think that it feels like it happened to somebody else?
That's an interesting question. Yeah, quite possibly. Yeah, because that was the last record that I made lyrically in that state of mind, because it was after that that I found sobriety. So, that was a real turning point. And I guess, yeah, I don't recognise that person. And when I see that person on YouTube, on videos of me talking at that time, I think, geez, who's he? You know, my hair slicked back, sweating face, quite thin and gaunt looking. I mean, that's quite scary. Yeah, you're right. Maybe that wasn't me.
I have that feeling. It's almost like a separate entity.
Well, it is. People describe the illness as Jekyll and Hyde, or the behaviour like Jekyll and Hyde and the different personas. And can you just touch on the mental health side, Chris, a bit? You've sort of said perhaps on one level you used it to your advantage creatively. Mm. Any kind of examples where you just thought, you know what, I don't want to go on anymore, I've had enough? Did it get to that point? Did you even contemplate those sort of thoughts of suicide even, or that sort of, I've had enough?
I did in 1974 have an attempt at that. So it's before all the major drug taking. And it's quite comical, really, when I look back at it, because I thought, right, no one's listening to me. I'm going to take loads of sleeping pills. I'm going to drink loads of vodka and everybody can just F off, you know. Mm. I really don't care. So I went upstairs in the house I was living. My friends were downstairs in the living room watching television. And I went upstairs and I put a wardrobe against the door and I took all these pills and I lay on the bed and I went, right, I'm off, you know, this is it. And then I thought, hold on, no one can hear me. So I got up, I moved the wardrobe, and then I was lying there and I started to cry, and then no one can hear me, you know, no one gives a shit. So then I opened the door and got back into bed, and still no one could hear me, so I went downstairs.
So it wasn't a very serious attempt.
I said, listen, I'm trying to kill myself here. Go away, we're watching Doctor Who. Sod off.
So it was a cry for help of sorts.
It was I needed a hug, but I didn't know how to ask for it. And I think that was more relationship driven. And around that time, I'd experimented with a lot of hallucinogenics, and I don't think they did me very, very, very many favours, to be honest. I couldn't quite cope with the change in velocity of mood.
But would you describe that as the kind of illness side of it, that kind of compulsivity that you just needed to get high, you wanted to kind of cut off, it was two fingers up to the world. Was it that?
Well, you say get high, I wanted to get low.
Okay.
So it wasn't like I was sort of dancing on my kitchen table in my underpants or anything like that. I was sort of under the table sobbing most of the time. And that's how I liked it. You know, I liked it, that kind of thing, which is odd. But, you know, I guess my mum before me, she was a keen drinker, and I enabled her to drink. And I think I sort of took a leaf out of her book, really, I would say.
Was she quite melancholic? Was she that type of
drinker? Yeah. I mean, you know, if she saw a spider sort of climbing down the wall, she'd sob. You know, she was like, oh, my God, that poor spider, you know, it's going to fall, you know, whatever. She was a very emotional woman. Mm-hmm. And I don't think the brandy helped, basically.
Yeah. And moving forward to, you've mentioned, you found sobriety.
Mm.
What was that process like? Was it an easy one? Did you surrender freely, or was it
with all guns crash, blazing? Bang, wallop? It was very higher power, I've come to believe. A friend of mine who was my drug dealer came back from America, and he'd been in rehab. And I called him up and I said, oh, you know, can I come around and get some drugs? And he said, I don't do that anymore. I'm clean and sober. And I said, you bastard, you know, how could you possibly stop? You know, you're my main feed, you know. And he said, well, Chris, we should talk about it. And I didn't want to talk about it. And then another friend of mine got sober, and he gave me his card. And I thought, oh, I'm never going to call it, you know. The band were about to go on a big American tour, and I got in my car with a really big hangover. I had to stop the car to be sick on the way to the airport. And on the way to the airport, I had to stop to see my kids, who were living in London with their mother at the time. And I pulled into the house, and I was still feeling sick. And I got on my knees at the door, front door, knocked on the door. And as my ex-wife opened the door and the kids were standing there, and I suddenly thought, what on earth is going on, you know? And I took a hanky out to wipe my face, and my friend's card came out with the hanky, with his number on it. And I called him, and I said, I think I need help. And within half an hour, he was around in a car. I got in the car and I said, look, I can't go now. I said, you know, I've got to go on tour. And he said, of course you can't, no. So we went round and round a roundabout for like 15 minutes, round and round the roundabout. He said, well, you can go this way to the Heathrow or this way to rehab. What do you want to do? And the next thing I knew, I was lying on a bed in the rehab. I couldn't make a decision. So they all got on the plane without me and went on the American tour, and I ended up in a hospital bed. And I was there for 12 weeks.
Twelve weeks?
Yeah.
Yeah. And what was that process like, those early days? Because people have different, you know, experiences from, wow, the war's over, sometimes people say, to what am I doing in this shithole?
Mm.
You know, when can I go back to my normal life so I can carry on drinking and drugging? And I'm sure it kind of goes up and down for many people. But what was your experience like?
I think by that time I was ready to surrender. And so when I went into my first group, I think there was 26 of us in a group. And quite a few of them were people that were suffering from eating disorders and anorexia and stuff like that. And I thought, what am I doing in this group? You know, I've got nothing in common with these people. That's what I felt at that point. And then there was like 10 alcoholics and drug addicts in the group. And I sort of felt more akin to them. Of course, I soon learned that we were all in the same pot, basically. Yeah, I just gave myself over to it. We had some fantastic counsellors there at that time, and they really knew how to catch me. And there was no getting away, because the great thing about addicts are they're very clever people, and they can wriggle out of any circumstance. And I could have talked myself out of there very easily, you know, but they were very clever counsellors, and they managed to keep me in. So it was an amazing time. And yeah, I look back, it was a place called Promise, which at that time was an amazing rehab run by a guy called Lefevre, and Dr. Lefevre. And I didn't really get on with him, to be honest. I thought he was a bit full of himself. But I've learned over the years that was me and not him.
Mm. And what happened there? So the band were out on tour.
That must have been very difficult for you going through that, as well as knowing that that there is this big tour going on.
Yeah, I felt an enormous amount of guilt.
Yeah.
That was
the guilt and shame that we all feel anyway.
Yeah, I mean, you know, everybody was out on the road and I felt terrible that I'd let them down. However, they'd written to me. Some of the band had written to me and showed a lot of support. So I kind of knew I was in the right place. So I felt the love coming back at that point.
And when you left rehab, did you rejoin the band again straight away? Or did you have a period of sort of...
We did go back on the road, and that was hysterical because they very kindly sort of cleared the tour bus of any alcohol and people were all being on their best behaviour. And I was saying, look, guys, for God's sake, you know...
It's sometimes worse, isn't it?
It's really...
Go, just have a drink,
just
for goodness sake.
Yeah. One of the band, Gilson, our drummer, was already sober, so he was a massive influence on me. And I, to this day, credit most of my recovery to him, because he was a real inspiration and he was very helpful.
How would he be? Just, can we dive into that one a little bit more? Because we know sometimes it is about the people around us, that kindness or that unconditional love or whatever you want to call it. Or sometimes it's that firm hand, isn't it? What was special about you and him, and what did you get from that relationship that clearly helped you?
Well, I'd observed a man who was basically an animal turned into a cuddly toy.
Right.
And he was a really lovely guy. And yet I'd been terrified of him up to the point of him getting sober. And the idea of being on a tour bus sleeping like only feet away from this monster terrified me. And then there we were on tour, and there he was in his bunk reading Alcoholics Anonymous book and like just being very quiet and lovely and being a very powerful drummer, which is what he is and he still is. And it was a very big inspiration to me. There was lots of inspirations, you know, at that time. My sponsor was Elton John, and that was an incredible lift for me because I thought, well, if somebody who's that busy can take the time to speak to me every day for a year, then there's hope for me. Mm-hmm. And what that taught me was that with my sobriety, I must give back what I've been given, because it is a gift. And he's always taught me that because he still does it. He still calls people up and still keeps people in his phone book, you know, and I think that's so important, so important. It's not about my, at this stage, 26 years later, it's not really about my sobriety. It's about holding out my hand so that somebody else can come on board, you know. And I hope I can do that in some small way.
Well, I think I've certainly seen you do it over the years with people and newcomers. We've also talked a lot, haven't we, Finn, about what, you know, are we, can we still create? Can we still perform without the drink, without the drugs? Can we still write? Obviously, in your case, you clearly do and can write still. Was that an issue at all?
No.
Is it better now? Is it the same? How would you just sort of describe it?
Well, it's interesting because some of the songs that we've been doing on this tour have been songs that we wrote when we were 22, 23 years old. And when you're at that age, you're sort of like a pinball in a machine. You're sort of rattling around all over the place, not knowing what bells you're going to hit. And you just write tons of songs when you get up in the morning. But now it's more methodical. You sort of have to find the time to write. In the past, there was loads of time. You know, there was no mobile phones or anything like that, obviously. So you just filled the day by writing songs, and now it's more mannered. But I enjoy writing more than I've ever done, and I enjoy performing more than I've ever done. So that's kind of nice at my ripe old age.
Yeah.
And the irony is, at the end of the day, we go back to our hotel rooms and have a cup of tea.
Yes, I had a mint tea last night before I went to bed, which
quiet,
is
quiet, calm.
Bizarre, you know. I mean, in the hotel room, there's like vodkas and whiskies, and they're all lined up, and then there's a mint tea, and I'm going, well, I have a mint tea then. And I'm thinking, wow, actually, I've never heard of that drink before. You know, there's like, what's that, gin? I've never heard of that gin before. It's like, Deptford gin? What about?
I have to
You're
ask my
Deptford,
son.
You're from Deptford, aren't you?
I'm from
Deptford. You would have heard about it.
Yeah, but, you know, jeez.
And how do you, if you see somebody in the profession who you can see is suffering from anything, do you speak to them? Do you confront them? Do you keep an eye on them from a distance?
Well, I don't see many people like that anymore. I think the industry has changed quite a bit. It used to be riddled with people getting drunk all the time and taking drugs. I don't see that so much, I have to say. Maybe it's the circles that I knock about in. But because there's more by way of music colleges these days, you know, people going off to learn to write songs and to be drummers and bass players and stuff, I think they're just not interested. They just want to get it right. You know, they want to be like Ed Sheeran or... You know, they want to be sort of clean and serene and, you know, maybe have the odd drink now and again. It's not such a big deal for them. They haven't grown up with the 60s behind them. You know, so, you know, when I was growing up, we had like The Who and Frank Zappa and, you know, the hippie era and the drug taking that was. They don't have that. They have parents that are sort of very clean and just watch Netflix. You know, when I wanted to be in a band, my parents went, you don't want to do that, you'll end up a drug addict, an alcoholic and skint. And they were right, you know. But parents today will say to their kids, oh, you want to be in a band? That's great. How can we help? You know.
Yeah.
It's completely changed.
I could honestly have sat here for the rest of the day. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
And thank you so much, especially after having played the Albert Hall last night.
Grateful to be here, thank you.
Yeah. No, you're definitely the coolest cat in the business, I think.
But that's not really the first time you've heard that.
I wanted to just get
it is today.
I'm the first today. Great.
We can't finish without saying a big thank you, as always, to Ibiza Calm, a residential clinic specialising in addictions and mental health. Without their support, this podcast would not have been possible. You can find out more about their fabulous work at www.tabithacalm.com. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
And if you've enjoyed listening today, please subscribe. And if you feel like it, you could give us a 5-star rating, which would be extremely wonderful. And we'd be very, very grateful. Thank you very much.
Nice one. Thanks, Chris.